We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
This is In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time. And welcome to the show. The Pelicans are on an 8-game winning streak. 8 games. They haven't done this since 2011, I believe, was the last time. So, Michael, tell us why it's never going to continue. Why should we be pessimistic?
Oh, come on. We're in the middle of excitement right now. We got 8 straight wins.
It's awesome. I sit down every night, and I'm excited to watch them play. I feel like they got a great chance against every team.
Yeah. I mean, they often get behind or do have little stretches that frustrate you, but, I mean, more than not, they play really good, fun, fundamental basketball. There's a lot of scoring, obviously, going on, which is always fun to watch, and they're hitting shots. And I think the thing that people are most connecting with them about is they really look like they're having fun and enjoying each other. And, like, that seems like such a simple thing, but there's times, even early in the season, where this team just seemed miserable and, you know, wasn't having a lot of fun together. And, you know, there was even stretches after that where, like, Diallo was the only guy celebrating off the bench. But this team just seems to really be having fun and enjoying playing the game. And then when that happens and you combine that with winning, I think everybody just gets on board.
So I'm going to flip something on you. On Twitter, you asked everybody what was the thing that they like best over this 8-game win streak. What was the most exciting thing for them? Let's hear it from you. What is your most exciting thing over this 8-game win streak? What do you point to and say, I didn't see that coming, or I saw it coming, but I'm so happy it's here? Like, what was the thing?
I still can't believe, and I know we talk about it a lot, I still don't think it's talked about enough, how much Drew Holiday has changed since the beginning of the year. Like, I've seen guys grow from season to season when they're young. I've seen guys like Mike Conley, who start off as a dud, people think, and turn into a stud. Like, I have never seen a single season transformation like this. Like, this guy was bad early in the year. Not overpaid, not, you know, not ideal. Like, he was a bad basketball player. He just looked scared. He looked timid. He didn't look like he had skills. There was no smoothness or fluidity. Now I feel like I'm watching one of the 5 to 7 best guards in the league, and it's not just that the shots are going in. The ball handling is another level. Like, it really feels like somebody kidnapped, like there was a switch that was done. I don't know if the switch was done before the season or after the season. It's just so hard for me to believe that it's the same human being playing right now that was playing in like October and November. I've never seen a single player in all the years I've been watching basketball be so different. And again, I don't want people to mistake and go, you know, and start bringing out stats. Oh yeah, you know what? Mike's right. He was averaging 8.3 points. Now he's, I'm not even talking about stats. I'm talking about the way he is playing, the way he is moving, the skill set that he seemingly has. It just, it blows me away every single night. The Milwaukee game, he looks like freaking prime Jordan. Then against Dallas, he's just being ultra aggressive and bullying guys down in the post and not settling. Like, who the F is this guy? That just continues to blow me away and intrigue me and incite me every time I play or watch. Because I'll be honest, I expect the next game that I watch for the old Drew to come back, and he just, I don't think he's ever coming back. I think this is our Drew Holiday.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing about Drew always has been, I felt like he could make it to the basket sometimes, but he preferred to pull up. He preferred those little mid-range jumpers or kind of floaters in the lane that, you know, or fadeaway shots, and like, he is bound and determined to make it to the rim. And he is happy if you are a smaller guy to abuse the crap out of you. He was not a physical player before. I would never have quantified him as a physical player, except for when he was getting up for a challenge. Like when he was playing against Russell Westbrook, you could watch him in those games. He would lock in and be like, "I'm going to get on this guy defensively." But he was never that offensively, and he always felt like a finesse player offensively. And this year, he's just embracing bully ball. He's embracing post-ups. Like, it is pretty impressive what he's been putting together. And over the last month, I don't think I've seen a shooting guard, and I'm using that term, you know, loosely, but I don't think I've seen a shooting guard this good since, what, Eddie Jones on the Hornets-Pelicans? I got to go back that far.
Eddie Jones was good. He slashed well and shot, but he didn't create like that. Like, it's just, it's the confidence. Like, he drives to the basket, and he's so sure that he's going to make it. He might have to, you know, use the left. He might go up and under with the right. He might, you know, have to finish with body contact, but it's like, it's just like he's so assured. Like, I watched a Drew Holiday for years that would sprint to the basket, and if he didn't pull up, would shoot it so hard against the backboard and just, like, had no touch and no grace. And, you know, I even joked earlier this year that he, like, reminded me of RoboCop. Like, there was no fluidity to him. And now I'm watching one of the most fluid scoring guards in the NBA. Like, it just continues to blow my mind to the point where if somebody tells me that the Monstars had captured Drew's, you know, essence for the last couple of years and now he got it back, or that he switched bodies with Prime Jordan, I don't know. But, like, again, it's not the stats. It's not that the shots are going in. I wish, like, somebody who had way more time than me would take side-by-side tape, not from years ago, but from October and November, and just put the drives that Holiday has right now up against the drive. Like, his ball handling at the beginning of the year stunk. And now it's like, he's going behind the back in traffic and so fluid and not, you know, just driven. Like, it's so weird that part of me still can't believe it, that this guy has grown so much from even just this year.
Yeah. And you said don't talk about stats, but I'm going to bring up some stats just because I think they're fascinating. I tend to believe that a player, once they reach age 25 or 26, are generally what they are. They're going to pick up a few more skills, maybe shoot a little bit better as the age goes on, but I don't feel like they change dramatically. He has moved his shooting attempts, percentage of shots, to the rim this year in a fashion I don't typically expect to see from a player who's been a lead guard for this long. He's taking shots at the rim or within, you know, 5 or 10 feet of the rim, almost like 8% more than he ever has in his career. And he's all the shots that he's taken have come from the 10-foot to the three-point line. So he's keeping a nice rate of three-point shots. It's still the second highest of his career. And he's just shifted everything else all the way to the rim. He's able to get there. And it's a pretty telling number that's a big transformation to be able to move that. Typically, as guys get older, it kind of moves further and further away from the basket. So, well, he's 27. He's prime. We've got him for another 4 years. So here's the question. Is there any chance that in a month from now it's going to be subpar Drew again? Or do you think this feels like something that could stick?
He's done this at different levels. He's never, in my opinion, he's never been this good. But he has been better and then down and up and down. You know what I strangely think has helped him more than anything is that, you know, people will look at his stats and go, yeah, he's good. I really wish he was just a slightly better three-point shooter. He's only 33% this year. I wish he was around 38 or 39. I don't. I think there was a stretch earlier this year right before he started playing exceptionally well where he was just dog tired and his threes were all coming up short, so he had a choice. He could either do nothing or he could start driving to the rim, and he just started attacking the rim. And I think that if he were a slightly better three-point shooter, he wouldn't be doing as well right now. And this is where, you know, I fight against the numbers only people is, you know, they'll say, well, if he was shooting 38%, that would be an effective field goal of this and that. But there's something about when you could rely on that 3-point shot and you're doing okay to get by that, you know, why am I going to run into the paint with these four big guys? And, you know, then I just got to run back further on defense and no, I'll just sit out here and shoot. I strangely think that because he's shooting worse from three, that has expanded his game. And if I had to guess, the only thing I think really holding him back is if he does shoot a little bit better from three, I worry about that because I think that he might attack and post up less. Of course, people will say, well, let's have the best of all worlds and him be just as aggressive and also hit his threes. And I just know human beings don't do that. I watched Patrick Ewing for years. When he hit his first jump shot of the game, he did not go inside. He just didn't, because why would you? So I really think that, as much as anything, has helped him during this stretch.
Yeah. So I guess the real next question, though, is whenever somebody asks him about his improved play, it seems like Rondo is one of the first things he mentions. Maybe not the very first thing. There's usually we decided to be aggressive or keep being aggressive. And then he brings up Rondo. So up at before this year, the most he's ever been assisted in New Orleans is on 21% of his baskets. This year, he's all the way up to 37%. And for those of you who don't pay attention to numbers like I do in an unhealthy way. Generally, lead guards float around 20% to 25%. Wing players who are just shooters usually sit around 80 to 90% of their baskets are assisted. And then wings who attack a little bit off the dribble usually sit around 50%. Big men usually 60%. So He is between a lead guard and an attacking wing, which makes sense based on the role they've had. But do you think the fact that he's able, this is a third of his shots that he makes, a third of them are assisted by somebody else. Do you think that really helps him a lot?
I mean, I think it helps. I think not having to be the distributor helps. And I know a lot of people want to point to Rondo, and even Drew does, but, like, again, these are all stats. That stretch in Milwaukee was the most impressive stretch I had ever seen from a guard not named Chris Paul in all the time I've been watching the Hornets and Pelicans. Like, he was amazing. And Rondo wasn't on the court. So, yeah, we could talk about stats and distribution and assisted and whatever. And I'm sure Rondo helped more than anything, just Drew knowing that, okay, I don't have to create for everybody so much. But to me, the skill set is still what blows me away. Like, he just didn't have that skill set in October and November. I don't care who was or wasn't on the floor. So, yeah, I think Rondo helps. I think more than, you know, anything, Drew just could go into a game going, okay, I don't have to worry about getting this guy set up or getting that guy looks or this. Like, Rondo's going to do that whenever he's in the game, and I could just go and attack. So I think Rondo being on the team mentally helps Drew just become a total badass and attacker. And so I appreciate him for that. I still think all the credit in the world's got to go to Drew and the coaches who have helped him out with the actual skill set.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to bring up, and it's not really necessarily related to Drew, but there was a moment in the Dallas game where there's a scramble for the ball. The ball dribbled out to Drew. He picked it up at the three-point line. He had a path to drive. He could shoot. He could do anything he wants to. And instead, he whipped a bullet right back at Shaq Diallo, who had someone near him, and Diallo put the ball in on a layup. And that was like a microcosm to me, because it does feel like, and this is such a cliche to say this about basketball, but it really does feel like this team has, you know, caught the passing bug to the point where they're almost always making the right pass. Where before it always felt like they might find it if they thought about it, but it wasn't like the natural thing. They weren't looking for their teammates really. But now it feels like everybody on this team is looking for their teammates in almost every spot to get them an open shot. And I want to give some credit. I think part of that's Cousins. I mean, Cousins was a black hole, but he also did find open guys on the perimeter fairly frequently. I mean, he made Darius Miller's life very easy out there. But that's probably my favorite thing about the whole season and the stretch is just you see a guy open and it's not Ryan Anderson who's going to catch the ball and he's shooting because he's Ryan Anderson. That ball will move if there's another open spot. And hell, guess what? It might actually bounce back if the defense collapses on that guy, which that was never happening. If Eric Gordon caught the ball or Ryan Anderson caught the ball, that ball was going to be jacked. And it's just so refreshing to see this. Like, how many times do we have conversations where Tyreek Evans would catch the ball, hesitate for that, you know, three quarters of a second and lose the advantage that the moving the ball gained the offense against the defense? And this team just keeps moving the ball. It's great. I love it.
Yeah, the offense is coming together. And to me, the exciting part is that you could still see all these little places that they can improve, and not just Big Boogie coming back and, you know, picking up where he left off, but you even see with AD that he's starting to gain a vision and being able to kind of play one move ahead when teams double team him. And, you know, you look at guys like a Darius Miller, Etuan Moore, and Ian Clark, who bring it some nights, but other nights, you know, they're not as big of a factor, and you just wonder what the team could be with a little bit more consistent guys at those spots, or if those guys, again, benefit from somebody like Boogie, which will help make them more consistent. I mean, I, you know, teams get better and better as they play together more and more, and this team hasn't even built that continuity yet, and you see it growing every time with things that you're talking about. And if they could just keep the coaching staff together a couple of years, keep the core players together a couple of years, like, you could really see, you know, what they're doing and kind of taking it to even another level.
Okay. I have another question for you. We've now seen him with a series of games under his belt for the Pelicans. What is your evaluation of Mirotić?
I think he's a guy who's going to try hard every single night. He will have some mismatches on the defensive end, but 80-85% of the guys you put him against, he'll figure out a way to not be a negative, and in some games he'll be a positive. So I think defensively, like, that's why I always laughed at the Ryan Anderson comparisons. He is an above average defensive player that's going to hustle and try. Offensively, he definitely has vision. You could see, I mean, he wasn't even really that up on the playbook. Obviously doesn't have chemistry with these guys or any kind of continuity. So you see as that starts to form and he's getting comfortable in some of his sets that he's getting better offensively, and he has all the skill sets. I just feel like, you know, he's that baseball player that doesn't really know where his areas are, what he could swing at and what he can't. I still feel like he doesn't really know the difference between a good shot and a bad shot. And sometimes that's good when you're hitting and your teammates are looking for somebody who could create their own or make a shot, make a contested shot, because you're not always going to get open ones. Like, I like having a player like that, but I still just feel like offensively, he doesn't really have the IQ when it comes to what the best shot could be for a given situation. And I know they're trying to play up tempo and getting the first shot off, and he's probably being encouraged. I just have the nagging feeling that those kind of things are the things that come back to bite you, and I would like to see him just show a little bit better discrepancy with his shot selection, but almost everything else I like.
Yeah. And I'll say there's a couple of moments where I was feeling a little bit pessimistic about some of what he was doing offensively, because it felt like he was either vanilla post-up kind of dude or face-up shooting from the wing or taking just a three-point shot wherever he can. And it didn't feel like there was a whole lot of variability in what he was doing, but you got to take a moment and just really step back and remember how long he's been with the team. And the hardest things to put into place are the ones where you're operating in the paint or at the elbows. Those are the things that really need a couple weeks in a training camp or something to talk about and work with your team. Because when you go into those positions, the space is tight, you make a mistake, and you've screwed up the whole thing. So they're trying not to put him into those plays. You can see him slowly adding plays that they used to run for DeMarcus Cousins. And he's slowly getting added into those bit by bit. But I don't think we're going to be seeing him operating anywhere in the elbow for a little while until he can have a little bit of time with these guys. And with the month of March and the schedule we're looking at, it's not happening anytime soon. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I like him as a player. I know that I don't ever have to worry about him not showing up for a game. And it sounds so crazy when you're talking about guys you're paying millions of dollars to play a sport, but, like, those are the kind of guys that I like having on my team. So, you know, some days he's on, some days he's not, but it feels like the nights that he's on, this team could beat almost anybody, even without Boogie. Like, that's how high their ceiling is on the nights that he's on, and I feel like they should feel good about the fact that they survived and won a couple of games when he wasn't playing well.
So, I mean, we have this long streak. Since the last time we've talked, they've had only they have games against Phoenix and San Antonio and Dallas. It felt like, to me, the one you were most excited about was the San Antonio game, which, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, they beat the Spurs, and the Spurs didn't even have Kawhi Leonard or LaMarcus Aldridge after the second quarter, so that's lame. They should have won by 87. So why were you so excited about San Antonio?
That was a remarkable accent. That sounded like a cross between the guy from There's Something About Mary, her brother,
yeah,
who constantly says, have you seen my baseball? And then Sling Blade.
Yeah.
So the fact
I try to, you know, change it up and keep things interesting.
Yeah, no, that was remarkable. Yeah, I mean, the San Antonio game was good, but I really liked the Phoenix game just because, you know, there was, you get behind, you're on a winning streak, and, you know, it's okay, well, knew it's too good to be true, and you just wind up losing to a team that you shouldn't because some of their guys are on that night. And then the team just decided that, you know, it felt like what Golden State always does to us. And it's just like, okay, that's cute. They got a nice little lead. We'll watch how quickly we could erase that and then just zoom ahead. So it feels like, you know, that this team is a little, in at least against other tiers of basketball teams, they're a little Golden State-ish, and they're, you know, they just have this kind of firepower that this team has never had before. So I enjoy that. The San Antonio game, it was fun. It was fun to watch this pop get crazy, but it was also nice to see. You know, I went into that game, I knew that Okafor had a terrible matchup and I wouldn't see much from him. But I really didn't think Diallo was going to be able to do anything in that game. And he had stretches in there which were promising, which kind of led into the Dallas game. So, I enjoyed that game. But the Phoenix game actually gave me a little bit more hope that this team could just turn it on seemingly whenever they want.
I don't frequently feel bad for other teams' players, but in Phoenix, I just felt bad for all of the big men Phoenix was rolling out there. Like, these were guys who were all picked pretty high in the lottery. Like Bender, he's young, he hasn't developed yet. Still, top eight. I think he was fourth, wasn't he? Chris was eight that year. Alex Len was fifth in a pretty strong draft that year, and everybody they put out there, Davis just tossed them around like they were children. It was embarrassing how badly he destroyed them. So, I felt a little bad for the Phoenix big man out there. It was man among boys kinds of moments. It was pretty dramatic.
Oh yeah, but AD just being completely dominant, like. My favorite moments this past week are just his aggressiveness on things, like when he's just grabbing rebound. Like, what was it, the San Antonio game where I sat there and I told my wife, I don't understand why they're trying to get the ball to Jrue Holiday to ice the game. I know he's going to miss these free throws. And then he does, but then Anthony Davis just kind of bullies everybody and does what he needs to do and gets the rebound. Like that in the Phoenix game, he was flexing on everybody. Like, just the fact that you could totally tell he believes he's one of the best players on the planet and he's just going to do whatever he takes. Yeah, it's been enjoyable to watch, and I don't really feel sorry for anybody, because I remember the days when Anthony Davis was a very undersized kid, essentially getting bullied around by bigger guys, so I like to watch him do it to other people now.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is one of those things, too, where and we still hear all the national media people who take pot shots at Davis still for not wanting to play center. I want to tell you to go do something, but I shouldn't say it in front of all the children listening to this podcast. So it rhymes with duck, and I'm telling you to go do it. But it's like he is finally man-sized. It's really what I got to say about this year. I mentioned at the beginning of the season when I first was watching him, this is literally the first season I feel like he's bigger than most of the people he plays against, that he's actually 6'11", and he can, you know, actually be out there and have the muscle mass to stick with LaMarcus Aldridge. Always before, he could out-swift LaMarcus Aldridge, but he couldn't out-muscle LaMarcus Aldridge, and now it feels like he could do that kind of stuff. And he does that, you know, Lopez used to march him under the basket and just pin him there. And, you know, Lopez isn't like a physical beast, but now Davis just plants his feet and pushes back, and they don't move. So it's pretty amazing seeing him out there reaching this potential. He's now 24 years old. He's about to go on a really sick run, and everybody should be really excited to see him at this size and the skill set. I mean, because he hasn't lost a lick of athleticism and speed getting to this point. So,
to me, we could talk about all the role and supporting players, and it seems like a different one or two show up every night, but this is what stars and superstars are supposed to do for your team. They, between Drew and AD, you know, you're going to be in every game. They're going to come and contribute on a high level every night. And then if you get a couple of supporting players to play above the norm or all collectively play together, you're going to win. But really the most impressive thing is that every night Drew and AD are just playing like all-stars, and that's where an eight-game winning streak comes from.
Yep. Next question I have for you. Who are you most worried about on this team? When you look down the roster and you've seen how they've been playing all this year, is there anybody you're looking at and saying, I don't think what that guy did earlier in the year is sustainable. I don't think what he's doing now is sustainable. I think he's going to wear out doing something. Like, who do you look on this roster and you're just like, yeah, that guy might fall off for us? Because inevitably every year that does happen. There are players who go on an upswing, and then they go on a downswing, and maybe they come back up again, maybe they don't. But who do you think is the because clearly we're on an upswing, is the person who might fall back down again?
Yeah, I mean, I think Darius Miller losing Cousins, like, he was always going to be the one the most affected by it, and I don't think that we could really expect from him. But honestly, they're on a 5-game winning streak since the All-Star break, and the only good game he really had was San Antonio, so they could get by without him. Etuan Moore is the guy that I feel like if he does, you know, when he gets in those funks, and you could obviously see him getting in his head, it just really hurts the team, because basically then they got to play Ian Clark, or, you know, I don't really know where they go for those other minutes, especially if I'm not expecting much from Miller. Like, it leaves this hole there. And I also feel like in these comeback games or in big games, it almost always seems to me that Moore hits the big shot. To either, you know, as the other team's going on a run, or as a team's coming back and it's getting close, like, Moore seems to hit those big kickout threes. And, you know, we've just seen games where he didn't have it, and those games are usually a little closer than they need to be. And he's just the one that worries me a little bit, that if they don't have just that other stretch guy, that other shooter that teams are worried about, that he doesn't attack. Like I talked earlier about how Drew's been two totally different men this year. Drew or Etuan Moore was two totally different basketball players in that San Antonio game. He was in his head the whole first half and just terrible. Somebody said something to him at halftime, and he just absolutely came out crazy in the second half, just attacking every time he got the ball. And if he could do that, this team is a dangerous offensive team. If not, he's an undersized guard who, you know, really doesn't do that well on the defensive end, and then now he's bringing, you know, offense too. So that's the guy that really worries me, that if he was a fluke, it's going to hurt him down the stretch.
Yeah, I have a hard time picking between him and Rondo, who I'm most worried about. Because, you know, Rondo gets in his own head too. He has games, and you even see it just inside of games sometimes, where he decides he's going to relentlessly hunt an assist, and it starts to really affect his aggressiveness getting all the way to the basket. He's not going to get all the way to the basket. He's going to get a little bit of penetration, and he's going to kick it to the first person who should be open and then expect them to shoot. And I think Rondo can go on stretches of entire games where he does that. So I'm a little worried that that might happen. But more, the thing that worried me a little bit in that Dallas game was he's still kind of effective, but he's wearing a knee sleeve now. And he talked about in the off season that he'd had a little bit of issue with his knee last year, but it was fully healthy. He was feeling good about this year. And he's been playing more minutes this season than he's ever had in his career by far. He's up to 32 minutes a game. He's a full-on starter minutes. They're riding him for a lot of minutes because of their weakness on the wing. And the most he's ever played before this was last year at not even 25 minutes a game. So I'm wondering if it's going to wear down on him after a while, unless some sort of help comes to give him more time to spell on the wing. But, yeah, those are my two worries most about this team that could cause it to fall off a little bit.
Yeah.
Any truth? Go ahead.
I mean, with Rondo, I see a lot of what you say, but I also feel like he just understands the game so well from a mental standpoint that he's going to be able to make some kind of positive factor. Like, Moore's not a leader the way Rondo is. Moore isn't a high IQ guy. He's not a guy who, if he's off, is going to be able to go get some rebounds or set other people up. Like, if Moore is off, if his offense between his shooting and then his little floater getting into the paint, the different ways he could score, if that's not on, he really brings your team almost nothing. And when he is off, you see it on his face, and you see other guys trying to lift him up, and then that means that they're expending energy and thought on him. Where Rondo, when he's off, he'll go to the bench, during timeouts, he'll be talking to coaches or players, giving advice. Like, even in his worst game, he is still going to find a way to make some kind of contribution for the team as a whole. And when Moore is off and when Moore can't score, there's just really nowhere else that he could help you.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you want to talk about? I guess we haven't talked about Cheick Diallo, and he had a pretty exciting game against Dallas. You brought him up for a little bit. So I think it's funny because on Twitter, for a long time, you always talked about how if Cheick got some burn, he could turn into something pretty good. You've had a little bit of stretch where you talk about how he has no real feel, that he's kind of goofy. So where does the truth lie there? Is he a player who could be a nice contributing big man on a pretty good team? Or is he really not probably going to develop to that point?
I really struggle because if I was just watching him with a keen eye, like, of a guy who's not on my favorite team, honestly, I don't think that he's going to make it as anything more than like a I mean, and now these guys got paid, but they won't move it. But like a Jan Mahimni or a Biombo, but without even the defensive prowess. There's just something, like, I've watched enough big men, and I know the big men in the league who have, you know, something that just, that really separates them. Like, there's a lot of tall guys that have tried to be in the NBA that could easily get above the rim and catch an alley-oop. But why do you think DeAndre Jordan made, you know, people are lining up to pay him $60, $70, $80, $100 million a couple years ago, but, you know, not willing to do that for other 7 foot guy. Like, he just has a different fluidity. His hands are different or better. He understands angles. Like, it's not just as simple as this guy has a bunch of energy and he could jump and he's long. There's just this certain something extra to me that separates big men, and I can't describe it any other way other than there's goofy guys and there's fluid guys. And Diallo is just, he's so goofy. Like, if there's a ball and it in traffic, Diallo will never come up with it. Now, if you give him a pass on a pick and roll where there's nobody around him, or there's a rebound to be had, again, where nobody is around him, he'll snatch it and look good. He'll throw down dunks with power, and you'll be impressed and get all excited about his potential. You put anybody near him, and he's fumbling the ball around. He doesn't really have the ability to leap and burst in traffic with his jump. It's just, if I'm being really, really honest with myself, no, I don't think he makes it because of what I'm describing, but I know I'm not describing that well. But I've seen enough big men come and go in my life that I know the difference between the ones who just have that it and the ones who have, you know, for no better words, just this clumsiness and goofiness that you're not going to overcome, no matter how many years you try or in the NBA.
Okay. I don't know. He feels like, to me, I still think he is still trying to adjust to what happens in the NBA, and he has to still learn some things. But I also, like, the way I look at him, even if he gets those minutes, he still feels like the kind of guy who has, like, a career where he could probably be in the NBA for 5 or 6 years at a lower tier spot, you know, making the minimum on a team, or maybe getting lucky and signing a Dante Cunningham 2-year, $6 million deal for somebody who wants to take a flyer on the 23-year-old or whatever. But he could also very easily go to China or to Europe and carve out a nice 12-year career where he's actually mentioned as one of the best players on the team and best players in a league. We've seen, like, Ajinsa was dominant in the French league. And, you know, I could see Diallo being able to do some similar sort of things in that kind of setting. So that's kind of where I am with him right now. It is kind of fun watching him when he has these explosive, energetic games, but you got to remember he's doing this against Dirk Nowitzki and Harrison Barnes, who's, you know, kind of given up on a season as far as I could tell in that game. And, you know, Dwight Powell, who's same sort of just a hustle player who can hit some threes. So I don't know. It's fun, but I wouldn't expect too much from him. Is he on the team next year?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're going to keep giving him tries, and he's still going to show flashes like he has this past week. And there's, you know, there's ways you could utilize a guy like that. Like, to me, he could be, even Kenneth Faried had, like, the fluidness in the hands that I'm talking about. Like, but I'm sure that there's guys, you know, in the league that just, have that energy and are able to play. And like I said, if he could put together a stretch for a couple of weeks like Biombo, he could make himself a ton of money. And we always get fooled by those guys because we go, well, he has this, this, and this. If we could only teach him X, then all of a sudden he'll be every, and like, it just doesn't work that way. Like, guys either have it or they don't offensively. And I'm not talking about the ability to shoot. I'm just talking about this, general movement and understanding of how to work angles on the court and so many of these other things that I know the people listening right now will say, I still believe in him, still gonna, and that's fine. You guys could do, you know, and believe whatever you want, but every fan base of every team ever who had a project guy believed that their guy was going to make it, and then they don't. So you're no different than any other fans, you know, so go ahead and believe and be excited about it. But I just, you know, I read the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, and they say that when, you know, you've spent enough time with something, you just know in your gut, and you can't really explain why. That's just how I feel about Diallo. I've watched enough big men that I just know that you just don't add that kind of fluidity and hands that I'm talking about, the ability to come up with 50-50 balls, et cetera. So I, you know, I'm liking what we're getting now. I think he's on the team next year. I like that between him, Mirotic, and maybe Okafor, that they could bring Boogie back together slowly, but I'm not expecting him to be a real good player. I think the best case scenario is he keeps putting up games like he did in the Dallas game, and then you can make him part of some kind of trade package next year when his value might be at its highest.
Would a Lou Amundsen career surprise you? That was the best comparison I could think of when I was going through. Is it feels like he's Lou Amundsen.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he's got a little bit more power, and like Lou Amundsen's not going to finish that dunk the way that Diallo did in the Dallas game, but yeah, I mean, I could see that, and that was a pretty long career, and
yeah, I
could see that, but I think that you and I discussing that right now is probably going to upset the majority of the fan base on a high, so let's just keep hoping for the best. But like, I used to think Capella, and he just doesn't have the movement or the hands that Capella has. So like, that is just not happening. Even though his genetic makeup and energy, you know, tell you that it could, it can't.
Okay. All right. So, schedule coming up, ready to move on to that.
Let's do it.
All right, so the schedule, of course, as we've been warning everybody for quite some time, is going to start going nasty because we're now in March. So the very first game that we're going to be facing, the wonderful Los Angeles Clippers, and we'll be playing them at the start of the road trip. Actually, I guess they played in Dallas, didn't they? So the road trip started Sunday. They go to L.A., then they have a back-to-back in Sacramento. Then they come home to face Washington, and Sunday they will be playing Utah. So there is a good four games between now and the next time we should be recording. Two on the road, two at home. Which of these four teams do you find the most interesting to talk about?
Oh, I'm afraid, but also excited about this Clippers game.
What's got you afraid?
Just that if you lose this game, like, it's this team is, I know Jason will say five games above 500, and I actually agree with him, but I don't want to confuse people on this podcast. They're 10 games above 500 right now. They're in an eight-game winning streak. They're playing fantastic. They could lose that game tomorrow night, just one game, and now all of a sudden they really got to be fearing for their playoff lives. Like, that's crazy.
And to be fair, just because of the way you said there, the Clippers aren't on an 8-game winning streak. The Pelicans are. So just want to say
that. Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, the Pelicans are playing as well as they've ever played, all the momentum in the world. And then all of a sudden, if they lose tomorrow, the narrative is not going to win. It's not going to be the Pelicans have won 8 of 9. It'll be the Pelicans are only one up on the Clippers, and the Clippers have the tiebreaker. Yeah. So, you know, it's just, it's great. Now you go the other way, and they go ahead and win this game, and then they got Sacramento the next night. People are talking about a possible 10-game winning streak, about a 3-game lead over the Clippers plus the tiebreaker, about, you know, a team that could have a 10-game winning streak and then are going home for, you know, a bunch of home games, and they only have, what, a handful of road games left. You know, that game is scary because, you know, all of a sudden, all of this momentum that's been built could all of a sudden come crashing down in just one night. And that's crazy. We all would have taken, you know, winning 8 of 9, you know, after they got their butt kicked by Philly or Minnesota. I can't even remember the last loss. We all would have taken 8 of 9, but now losing this Clippers game all of a sudden, you know, could really scare us, where I think people are legitimately thinking 3 or 4 seed, you lose that game, and now all of a sudden people will be worried that the Pelicans could be on the outside looking in when it comes to the playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Clippers have been playing fairly well. I mean, I will say this is always the schedules in the NBA mean a lot. There is a reason why Utah went on a terrible losing streak and then went on an awesome winning streak. And it was because they had a horrid December schedule, and then January, as you'd expect after you had a horrid schedule, lightened up, and they got some games going, and they felt really good, and they played really well together, and they carried it forward. The Clippers, in the last month, depending on how you feel about the Nuggets, beat either 1 or 2 good teams. They beat the Nuggets by 2. And they beat the Celtics by 10 when the Celtics were in one of their funks. Otherwise, they basically beat crappy teams and lost to the good teams. So you could say the Clippers are a pretty impressive team. Like, I don't think anybody expected them to really be 34-28 at this point in the season. But tell me, why should we be scared of the Clippers? What do they have that would be particularly devastating against this Pelicans squad?
I mean, so look, this is one thing that I've really come to realize as I've gotten older with sports, is that I think sometimes we look at things like there's such huge gaps between the good and the bad, or the great and the good. And in reality, like, the gaps are minuscule. Like the Pelicans and Clippers, you know, if the Pelicans score one less point a quarter, or not even a half a less point a quarter, and the Clippers score, you know, a half more point per half, like, then according to expected win or whatever, the Clippers are 7 games better than the Pelicans this year. Like, this idea that teams are that much better than each other, even the good teams versus the bad teams, we're talking about a difference of like a point per quarter. You know, I started realizing this with golf when Tiger went from being the best player in the world to, you know, not even making cuts. And you would look at his average score, and he went from like an all-time great 68 per round to now he's shooting a 70, you know, on average in a round. And what that is there's one putt per 9 that he misses instead of makes. And anyway, just in a roundabout way to answer your question, what scares me is that this is a team that's not much worse than the Pelicans. And, you know, when you put two teams like that together, one shot going in, you know, or one shot not going in for the Pelicans, is the difference between a win and a loss. And
you're at LA, you know, they have guys that could get hot, and part of me feels like the Pelicans have just put so much pressure on themselves and extended themselves so much and played so many minutes during the streak that the shoe's going to drop eventually. So are the Pelicans better than the Clippers? Yeah, sure. But even if that's the case, you know, that by no means guarantees a victory or even gives me a victory more than 50% of the time. So I can't really point to anything specific and say this matchup or that matchup or, you know, blah, blah, blah. I just feel like if these two teams play right where they are right now in this point of the season at LA 100 times, it's going to be somewhere around 50-50, and I just don't know which universe I'm in and who wins tomorrow night.
So I just want you to know that it's you didn't have to go into that long description. You could have just burst into tears and said it was Austin Rivers.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. Or which Austin Rivers are we going to get? But, I mean, like, you're joking, and I appreciate the joke, but that's kind of my entire point. Like,
yeah.
We could look at Austin Rivers and go, oh, he's shooting 43% on the season and the whatever. But tomorrow might be the night that he goes 6 of 8 for three. Or he might go 1 of 7. And the Pelicans win or they lose based on this some kind of randomness. We like to think that the best teams win and, you know, that we could go ahead and predict. But it's just, it's so volatile because teams aren't really that good or that bad. The difference between almost all of these teams, you know, aside from like the Warriors and the truly exceptional teams, are so minuscule that it's really just a series of coin flips. And we like to think it's more than that, but it really isn't. So I don't know. All I know is that the Pelicans could very well lose tomorrow night. There's many different situations in which they lose tomorrow night's game. And if they do, all of a sudden the high just gets, you know, taken out from under us. So I guess that's why I say, you know, I would be worried.
Okay. So then let's do the normal thing we do. Who is the one guy, though, that could, you know, just torch us? The guy that you're most worried about?
I would have said Tyrone Wallace, but luckily they did not keep him or extend him for the rest of the season. So he's back on their G League team, and he can't play for them anymore because he's been up for the 45 days or whatever. But that guy, the last time we played him, he was – I know other guys scored more, and Blake came up big in the fourth. He was the guy that impressed me the most. So I would have said him, but since it won't be him, I'm going to go with Milos. I think they put Drew on somebody else, and especially I think that they could use him to lock down Lou Williams late in the game. But I worry that Milos is going to get open, and he's making 2 threes per game this year. I say he hits 4 tomorrow.
Okay.
Who scares you?
Austin Rivers. But and it's like I don't want to say that because I've spent so much of my time mocking Austin Rivers that I now feel like a schmuck for saying Austin Rivers could be the light up guy. But I don't worry about him driving to the basket and scoring on us because I think he's garbage at that. I think he's always been garbage at that and he'll always be garbage at that. But he does have his moments where he can get hot from three, and those nights you're just gonna have struggle. And I think that's I think he's the one. I am always tempted to say people like Tobias Harris because we don't really have a really good, you know, small forward defensive player on this team. But Harris has always felt to me, and I know he had, I think, one pretty good game against us recently, but he always just feels like a baseline guy. Like, if you have him on your team, he's going to go out there and he's going to take 17 shots. He's going to score 20 points for you. And he's just going to lay a nice little baseline. But you shouldn't expect him to come out and suddenly put down 38 on the other team. He just doesn't feel like he's capable of that. So I just don't fear that guy. And Lou Williams, he's an obvious candidate, but he's also a leading scorer. So being surprised that Lou Williams is going to score a bunch of points on you when he's averaging 23 points a game, that's just you being stupid. So, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I guess let me ask though, tomorrow's game, let's say that Okafor can play, he gives it a go. We saw this team against Dallas start Nico. We also saw Diallo play really well. If Okafor could go tomorrow, do you go back to starting him, or do you like anything that you saw in the Dallas game better?
Well, I mean, the things about the Dallas game I like better, but you also have to remember the strength of their big men in Dallas is pretty limited. And, you know, if you can spell Davis from having to check DeAndre Jordan for 14 minutes in a game, you do it. So have Okafor out there and have him do that work. I find it really cute that you think that Okafor is going to play for us. You realize he signed for the rest of the year, and our general history is that once we bring in a player, they play well enough to sign for the rest of the year, then they immediately get injured for the rest of the year. You know that's what happens, right?
Yeah, okay. I mean, I was trying to be optimistic here, Ryan. I think you give Okafor a little shot at DeAndre Jordan and try to keep him off the boards, but I don't know. I really like the idea of bringing DeAndre out and playing Mirotić and AD a little more. And I know you might have to sacrifice a couple of offensive rebounds to Jordan, and in those moments it'll be hard not to put another guy on the floor. But I think over the course of the entire game, I think going a little smaller against LA will be beneficial. Maybe you have Okafor in the beginning of the games where Jordan is bullying a little bit more, just to take the brunt of the physicality. But hey, I'm just interested to see what they'll do if Okafor is able to play tomorrow.
Yeah. All right, so the rest of the teams, we've already played Sacramento a couple of times. I think everybody's pretty familiar with what they've got. We seem to talk about Utah more than we really need to, so I don't feel like talking about Utah. So I guess that leads me to talk about the Washington Wizards, which, you know, the Pelicans don't cross paths with very often because the Wizards are on the Eastern Conference and the Pels are, of course, in the West. The Wizards lost John Wall to an injury. He should still be out. I think he's just returning to some light work, so he should not be back by Friday. But he went out and they immediately started ripping off a bunch of wins. And that was like a big story. Oh, you know, they're playing so much better without him because they got some big wins. They beat the Raptors. They beat the Thunder. They beat the Pacers. They almost took out the Celtics. Like, they had some pretty nice wins in there. But they've now suddenly gone on a little bit of a losing streak. They've lost three in a row. They play the Heat tonight. But in general, they're basically relying on Beal, who's being asked to do a lot more than he ever has before. He's actually averaging something like double the number of assists that he normally does during this time period. And they've, of course, got some nice wing play with Porter and Morris at power forward. And Gortat's always good for some dunks. The fun guy that they brought on, which people haven't probably heard about, is Satoransky. He was actually on the team last year, but it took him a little while to actually get things going, and he's come out this year, and he's been playing a lot of backup point guard and playing next to Beal some as well. So look for him. He's shooting pretty well. He can get into the paint, and he has a kind of a Joe Ingles kind of vibe to him where he fakes on the perimeter, gets into the middle, and then makes the right pass. And he's not going to get to the basket and dunk on anybody, but he's going to get into the middle and make the right pass. So it'll be interesting to see. Anybody on this team terrify you? Are you scared of Kelly Oubre Jr.?
I've seen Tim Frazier have, you know, really good games against teams he's motivated to play against. You know, when he went up against Portland and Lillard and I mean, I could see if there's just a random guy that's going to come. I could see Frazier being motivated and, you know, putting up an above average game against the Pelicans. So he would kind of be the one. But no, I mean, what I'm most excited about in this game is just for Drew to lock up Beal for 36 minutes. And, you know, I hope that the people who vote for things like Defensive Player of the Year or All-NBA Defensive Team don't just do it based on reputation, which I'm kind of afraid they do because Tony Allen got way too much recognition for too many years after he wasn't nearly as good as he used to be. But, you know, I'm hoping that, like, games and opportunities like this could put Drew on the stage and, you know, I really hope they just unleash him on Beal for as many minutes as possible and just completely shuts him down.
Yeah, and what a lot of teams, it's happening more and more. So if you guys are watching, pay attention to this. They did it a ton to the Pelicans in Phoenix. They did it a little bit with Dallas. They didn't really have the personnel to do it. San Antonio did it a lot. They'll run when Drew's out there and he's locking in on the guy they want to have with the ball in their hands. A lot of teams have started running guard-guard pick and rolls, and because they know the Pelicans are going to switch. So the Pelicans switch, and the guard with the ball has now got the weaker defender, and they've gotten rid of Drew, who now goes off and guards the other guy. So that's what a lot of teams have been doing to counter this. There isn't a whole lot of two guards that can do that sort of thing here in Washington with Wall out. So if Beal runs a guard-guard pick and roll, like, who's going to be the other guy who's got to be guarded as a guard? Both those guys have to be a threat to receive the ball and attack. And in Washington's case, it's just not something that they need to worry about. So it could be fun. Could be interesting. Satoransky, maybe. Maybe he's going to be the guy who tears us apart.
I mean, he is very skilled and he's playing well. I don't think they utilize him enough, but he's definitely a guy that, you know, I could see breaking out somewhere wherever he goes in the next year or two. Yeah, he's definitely an extremely skilled player, and you see that more with Wall out. I've watched them quite a few times, and that was very clear that you see this guy on the court that just moves well, has good handling, has, you know, IQ, kind of sees the floor. Not the greatest defender, but you see a lot of offensive tools that he has. So he would be one of those guys, if I'm a GM, just kind of tuck and put away and hope that, you know, he gets kind of lost in the mix when Wall comes back, and eventually he could be had for below what I, you know, value him as, because I see a lot of talent there with him. So it wouldn't absolutely surprise me, but I don't think Washington utilizes him enough. So I'm not completely worried. He's not going to be another Alex Abrines, put it that way.
Okay. All right. So we got four games. Like I said, L.A., back-to-back with Sacramento, and then at home versus Washington and Utah Friday, Sunday. What is your predicted record for the week?
I'm going 3-1. All my guts, I keep just feeling like the other shoe's going to drop, but I'm just going to be positive. I'm saying that they're going to have a 3-1 week, and that would make them, what, 38-27 or something like that?
39-27.
Wow.
39 wins already. That'd be pretty nice to have bank that in, you know, the second week of March.
Yeah, I'll do a 3-1 week.
Okay.
Come on, say 4-0. Do it.
I'm eyeballing the Utah game. I just feel like, you know, I don't know. I have such a bad grasp at what Utah actually is at this point. I've seen Utah playing like nobody could beat them, and I've seen Utah playing like they're garbage. And I can't figure out which one they are.
They're always a good defensive team, always, that when they hit their shots, they could beat anybody. When they miss their shots, they're going to lose a very ugly game. But the one constant is that defense every single night.
Yeah.
So
what the hell? 4-0. I'm gonna go 4-0. They're gonna go on a 12-game winning streak.
I like it. This is kind of like when Yao went down and McGrady just let
22 in a row.
Yeah, that's what we're in the midst of right now.
All right, got anything else to talk about?
That is it. Got to go back and watch season finale of The Bachelor now.
All right, so you go enjoy that and collect a rose or whatever the hell they do in that thing.
All right, have a good one. Can't wait till come back on this 12-game winning streak podcast.
Yeah, thanks for listening to In the Know.
For the ones who know that a little late is always too late, and that the clock doesn't stop just because you're missing a part, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, and our KeepStock inventory management solutions help ensure you have the right stuff in the right place at exactly the right time. Visit Grainger.com/KeepStock to learn more. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.